Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is an MCRT Wii. Now, you heard Matt Shuba talk about ARDS in the right ventricle on MCRT recently, and it was a fantastic lecture. I wanted to bring him back and talk about another aspect of the clinical work that he does, which is promoting the concept of Zentensivism, which is a philosophical outlook on how clinical care to the critically ill should be delivered. And I really think you're going to love it. So without further ado, let's hear all about Zentensivism. Matt Shuba, you're back. We had you on last time to talk about and the RV in ARDS, but today we're going in a different direction. We're going to talk about Zentensivism, a movement that I believe you are the founder of. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Zentensivism?
Sure. Thanks, Scott, for having me back. Just really thrilled to be here again. So Zentensivism is a holistic approach to the art of caring for the critically ill patient. And the really important thing there is what holistic means in this case, because that can be softer, poorly defined things in other settings. What we're really thinking about is, how do I take the best care of this whole person, whatever their goals and their values are, in the context of what I can actually medically achieve for them in the most minimally invasive way possible?
I love that. I completely subscribe to this idea. And when you first started espousing it, I'm like, oh, yes, absolutely. Though I got to say, and this in no way detracts from the ideas, but the name is horrible, Matt. And I say that because I actually trained in Zen meditation for many of formative years during my teens. And we've now taken the American mode of using Zen to represent something very different than I think its origins would have us represent it as. How do you respond to that?
That's a fair criticism. This paper did cause, in the peer review process, that did come out a little bit. Some people were like, oh, this kind of feels a little off base. Like you, Scott, though, I'm also a Zen meditator, trained as such. I've been reading Zen philosophy for 10 years leading up to writing this paper. I understand it's not exactly the same thing, but just bringing that sort of calm, centered presence to the critical care setting was really what we were trying to go for. And actually, the first time that I wrote the paper, we wrote it with each of the principles underneath each element of the Eightfold Path. So it really actually was even more tied into Buddhism than it used to be. And that was distracting for people. So we tried to clean it up a little bit.
Oh, I love that so much. And it gives, I think, more credence to your use of the term then, that it actually is with the understanding of the philosophy inherent in it. It's not just a grab for a word that I think much of the West has done. So that's fantastic. But a word that you could use in lieu, because you talk about this a lot, is essentialism. So tell us about how essentialism relates to this idea.
Essentialism, in the way that is defined in a more recent pop nonfiction book, is the way that I mean it, more than the classical philosophical essentialism. Essentialism, in this case, is just doing absolutely what the patient needs and not focusing on anything else. And what I mean by that is, we get focused on all these little details, especially those of us like me who are from internal medicine background. We like want to talk about the sodium. Like, if it's 132, we have to spend 20 minutes talking about sodium, talking about making all the electrolytes look pretty, trying to turn all the little red alert flags in the EMR to normal. Those are the kind of things that are distracting from the main message. The other thing is, I think that's the first thing is, I always ask my trainees, tell me, okay, what are the primary organ failures, or what is driving this problem? That's where we need to spend our time. Then the other place where you need to, so that's the sort of physiologic and that drought brought a lot of us to critical care. But the other part of that is, does this make sense in context for this patient based on where they are in their sort of healthcare journey? Is this somebody that's been repeatedly hospitalized, institutionalized essentially for the last 6 months? Am I meeting them at the end of the road? Or is this somebody that has some recovery potential? And then finally, what are they willing to put up with to get there? Those are the essential elements. And then we have to add things in that we really should be doing all the time, that we don't spend a lot of time thinking about or talking about on rounds, except as part of a checklist. Is this person, are we trying to minimize how much we're sedating them? Are we trying to get lines and foreign devices out of their body? Are we trying to restore their environment to be something that a human would understand? Are they able to walk around? Can they see their family? Can they communicate with us in any way that's possible? Those are the elements that are really essential. And then all this other stuff just becomes window dressing, but the window dressing we tend to get over-focused on.
Absolutely. The motto of MCRT is maximally aggressive care. And I often have considered getting rid of that because it gives the false impression of what I actually mean, because they just think it's this gung-ho, just throw everything at the patient, be as invasive as possible. It's not that at all. It's just a balance of maximally aggressive curative care when balanced. And the balance is absolutely key, with maximum espousal of dignity. And dignity is the word that guides my palliative care. It guides my treatment of patients. And I know that word has resonated as well all throughout this intensivism movement. Tell me your feelings on dignity.
Yeah. So similar to your philosophy, one thing, the phrase that we use is minimally invasive and maximally attentive. So the idea is to try to do just the right amount of what is needed for the patient and just observe what happens. And the observation, the power of observation is a large thing of what drives the benefit of the ICU. It's not all what we do to people. It's the fact that we can sit there and watch them really carefully. As part of that process, we're not only observing the physiologic variables in the labs, but we should be observing what's happening to this person. What are they experiencing? Just because we're going to quote unquote do everything for them, let's say in some cases, doesn't mean that we're not being really attentive to whatever pain or anxiety or dyspnea or other things that, you know, people think about as more quote unquote palliative is really a core part of the care that we provide. Because if somebody's suffering despite all this, the sequela they're going to come away with from this is going to be really devastating in ways that we would never wish upon ourselves or those that we love. So we really need to be attentive to that. And then the other aspect of dignity is, if we are really approaching an end of life situation, how can we make sure that we treat that situation with the same level of care and attentiveness that we do when we're doing, let's say, a massive resuscitation?
Now, a big portion of the minimalism, the essentialism of Zen-tensivism is the avoidance of eubaxia and the normalization trend of trying to get all parameters into this arbitrary range of normal. Tell me a little bit about that, Matt.
Yeah, that's an example of, we look at how the things that we actually do to people versus what they actually might need. And what I mean by that is, we assume that anything that is abnormal in a critically ill patient is something that needs to be fixed. What we don't understand is how much of that is evolutionarily preserved adaptive mechanisms that we don't completely understand. And what if in some cases a lower blood pressure is something that's adaptive, and taking that away with using vasopressors, for let's say, or we're trying to force lab values to normal, that usually takes a good amount of effort, not only cognitive effort, but medication effort and things like that, or ventilator prescription changes. We're going to try to take somebody that's got somebody that we now at least acknowledge that permissive hypercapnia is something that we should shoot for, changing that to something that we chase away from, something that we try to chase away. So it's all those kind of those areas. The problem that we have as a medical system is that we assume that anything as abnormal is associated with the patient, means the patient's going to get sicker unless we fix it. But there's probably a wide band of things that are abnormal, possibly compensatory, or at least not harmful, that we can just ignore. What we need to do as a research endeavor is to try to increase the number of things that we can fit into that definition. Because if we're going to replace every potassium that falls under a certain level, we're going to exert a ton of effort doing that, maybe not change any outcome whatsoever, except maybe make the patient more uncomfortable because it burns when the potassium goes in the IV, right?
Absolutely. Now, you have a triangle of the minimalism of Zen-tensivism. And one point of the triangle is humanism. We already talked about that in terms of dignity. But the other two are clinical mastery and risk tolerance. And these are really essential if you want to be a Zen-tensivist. Tell me about those two.
So risk tolerance feeds right into this topic of what abnormal values can you tolerate. And this is something that I think on some level is the way that we're programmed, right? We think based on if you see a patient, how much are you willing to let them stray from what you would consider normal? How long are you going to let this patient stay on, let's say, high flow nasal cannula? How long are you going to let them persist to have, let's say, peripheral vasopressors instead of having a central line? Those are the kind of areas to think about. And another is the diagnostic uncertainty piece. Do you think every patient that comes to the ICU needs a CT for pulmonary embolism rule out? Or are you willing to say that, let's say, that troponin elevation is related to stress and we're not going to fully investigate that? That is something I think you can get better at with time, but it takes really deliberate practice and observing what happens. Say, oh, you know what, the 99% of the time when we trend that troponin, nothing happens. Nothing useful happens of that, except we saw the lab go down, pat ourselves on the back. The other thing is observing from colleagues who are more or less risk tolerant than you, you can see what the implications of that are. And sometimes seeing what happens when people are less risk tolerant is actually very useful, because you could say, oh, you know what, they didn't want to let this lab abnormality go by. And as a result, they caused this complication trying to fix it. So I think those are instructive moments, especially for trainees. Trainees are in a really unique position to develop this, because they will work with everyone with a full sort of spectrum of risk tolerance, and they'll get to see the benefits and risks of all those. The clinical mastery piece is the most important part of this. There are a lot of trainees are very excited about this idea of Zen-tensivism, but they may not have the right knowledge or skill set yet to be able to properly employ it. It can very easily accidentally slide into nihilism if you don't know what you're doing. You say, oh, I'm not going to overreact to this, I'm not going to overreact to that. You don't even know what you're looking out for. But clinical mastery allows you the space to say, I've seen this condition this many times over the years, and this is my understanding of the natural history of it based on my clinical experience and based on what is in the literature about this. And I know the bounds of what I can expect out of this condition. There are extraordinarily good outcomes for this or extraordinarily bad outcomes for this, but most of them, we can see where the bell curve lies. That's a really important thing. And that also improves your ability to monitor things carefully without overreacting to them, to say, okay, yes, the patient's on high flow nasal cannula, they're on a high level of FiO2, but based on their clinical signs that I see, I'm willing to monitor them up until X period of time in which I feel like I would need to make an intervention to improve upon this.
I love that. If I was going to add anything to this triangle, it would be to make it a diamond and have the word diligence there, because what the enemy of Zentensivism is laziness, because it's hard. It's so much easier to just reflexively say, yeah, get the CT, or yeah, replace their potassium. And it's actually saving you from the cognitive use of decision-making, because decision-making is hard. And the more decisions you make, the more difficult that day is, the more glucose you've burned. And it requires a level of care that's at times really difficult. But that diligence is absolutely the key to keep going, because it's easier to be a crappy doctor that just reflexively deals with everything that comes up. It's really hard to be a Zentensivist. How do you persist in that, Matt?
So for me personally, it's a little easier because I view this as a moral obligation, right? So I have to, in order to achieve the goals of Zentensivism that I'm trying to achieve, I have to be at this level of diligence. And I always try to tell my trainees, I want to be the doctor that they want taking care of their family. And that's the way that I guide my approach to these patients. So no one's a VIP, but that means I have to pay attention to everybody really carefully, especially when I've opted to do something that's less invasive than what would be conventionally done. That means I do have to go back to the bedside every hour, or I have to follow up on different values in a more diligent way than I would have before. I absolutely agree with the addition of diligence, because the last thing I usually say when I give a talk on this topic is that doing less takes more effort.
Yeah.
And this is an example of that, right? So if you're going to say, I'm not going to reflexively intubate this patient because they're on X level of FiO2, not only does it require more monitoring on your part, but also requires explanation why you're doing that. Explanation to the nurse, the respiratory therapist, the resident, the family, potentially the patient. But you say, okay, but if we reach a certain threshold, I'm going to change my approach, because you want them to know that you're there and caring, not that you're there and just blowing things up. It's a huge difference between disengagement and Zentensivism, and they really don't look the same at all. They both may well have fewer orders on the computer, but they look very different in practice.
That's fantastic. Along those lines is one of my favorite quotes from your Zentensivism talk on Maryland CC Project, which, and I'm sure I'm paraphrasing here, 2 weeks in the ICU could easily save you 45 minutes of conversation. I thought that was fantastic. And that speaks to the fact that you're going to do a lot more speaking about care as a Zentensivist than necessarily even doing care, because that's where the work is, communication and the explanations. Now, but along those same lines, does Zentensivism imply or require a degree of paternalism? Because you are making judgments based on whether care is indicated based on our vision of the benefits of it. And speak to that a little bit, because I consider myself to be paternalistic, or at least more paternalistic than the norm. For me, how I gear palliative care discussions is really based on a holistic vision of the patient's level of life quality, and then tempered, obviously, by the wishes as expressed by the patient in the past or the family right now. But I am making judgments, and that seems to be almost forbidden now to make those kind of judgments. Tell me a little bit about how paternalism fits into Zentensivism.
Yeah, that's a great point. I have to first just, I guess, disclaim that quote, which is beautiful, is not mine. One of those clever guys from ANZIC said it some years ago, and I picked it up. But the point you make is great, and I think it really depends on how we define paternalism. We've gotten so afraid of paternalism now that we're unwilling to make recommendations to people when we're the experts in this field, right? Even if sometimes we are a little harsh on our oncology colleagues, we say, well, they didn't really have this discussion, blah, blah, blah. And they come to us and I have to tell them, okay, we might not know the background of the oncologic care very well, but we know very well what happens to a patient with relapsed leukemia who goes on a ventilator with multi-organ failure, right? And that's not a no-win situation, but that's a very low probability of success. And it really is incumbent upon us to share that frankly with the family It doesn't mean that you try to pressure somebody into something or you guilt them into or try to make them feel guilty about the decisions that they're making. But you have to levy your position as an expert and say, based on my understanding of this disease process, similar patients have done very poorly in this situation. The vast majority have died. Anyone who's lived has had incredible functional dependence as a result of it. With that in mind, we should reconsider what we originally talked about, quote unquote, doing everything in this situation, and talk about what level of suffering your family member is willing to experience, knowing that the outcomes are very likely poor. And I try not to be absolute because obviously there's exceptions to everything. We've been here before. We know what it looks like. We've gotten so afraid of paternalism now that we offer a menu of choices to people, and then the menu is regarded as all of them are equal and they're all equally weighted. They're all equally beneficial. So you say, okay, we can do CPR and intubation, or we can be comfortable. That's not really a choice. You just gave, that's a false choice. So we need to move to a place where we're giving the people at least an opportunity to make an informed decision. Then if they make a decision which you don't agree with, but you think is medically reasonable to do it, then you enact it and say, okay, we're going to take this one step at a time and see how this goes. And we'll keep revisiting this conversation as this illness walks through its paces.
I've loved this discussion so much. Is there any parting words you want to give people on Sentensivism?
The last little piece about how doing less takes more effort is really the most important piece. There's a lot of reasons to want to do this. You want to make sure that you don't inflict unnecessary suffering upon people, especially if you feel like they're very unlikely to benefit from it. You want to streamline your workflow a little bit. You want to make it so it's easier to focus on the things that actually matter for the patient. But it does take a tremendous amount of work. If you're a trainee, you're going to be able to do this at best in a limited capacity, but learn from the people that are supervising you, both the things that you want aspire to and the things that you would like not to emulate. But just know if this is a care path that if you adopt it, it takes a lot of work, but I find it exceptionally rewarding, and that's why I continue to do it.
Fantastic. Now we're going to recommend people watch your Maryland CC lecture, read the Zentensivist Manifesto, which we'll link in the show notes to this. And there was actually additional reading that you had in that lecture that we will link to as well. Matt, I can't thank you enough for coming on again. This has been fantastic.
Thanks so much again, Scott. I really appreciate it.